This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You're listening to The West Wing Weekly. I'm Hrishikesh Hirway.
And I'm Joshua Molina. Today, we're talking about Episode 7, Season 1 of The West Wing.
The State Dinner.
It was directed by Tommy Schlamme and written by Aaron Sorkin and Paul Redford. It aired originally on November 10th, 1999.
It's worth noting that on this episode, Alice Daniels, the costume supervisor, and Lynn Paolo, who's the costume designer, they were nominated for an Emmy for Outstanding Costumes. And Lynn Paolo is the costume designer for Scandal as well.
She's a lovely person. And a little bit later, we're going to catch up with her and talk to her about her work on this episode.
Do you guys work together a lot? Is it like hair and makeup where you see her on every episode?
No, she's too important for me. No, she is the ultimate eye, and I will occasionally, at the beginning of a season, I'll have a big fitting with her, and then later in the season, as I put back the weight that I lost in anticipation of the season, I'll have a second fitting where she lets out all my suits. Somebody like Kerry Washington probably sees her much more frequently throughout the season, I'm sure, for every episode.
You're just wearing a suit. You're not wearing special fancy dresses every time.
Yeah, that's true. Although, you know, she has a great eye for detail, and how character informs dress and vice versa. And so, for instance, when my character became the Attorney General of the United States, as he likes to point out.
On Scandal, David Rosen.
Yes. He was making a little more dough and bought slightly nicer suits. And so, you know, as I came up in the world, I started to express that in the clothes I was wearing.
Well, what did you think about this episode?
I felt this episode was a bit thin.
Wow, really?
Are we going to fight?
Maybe, yeah.
For me, it was a little bit diffuse. There was a lot going on, which is not something to which I object, but almost all of it took place off camera. And I felt in this particular instance, it was a little bit of a weakness. There was a lot going on, and for me, a lot of it strained credibility.
I think I liked it because I think my favorite episodes of The West Wing, the ones where there's an admission of how difficult the job is, and sometimes you end a day and you don't have a victory.
Bartlett dealing with so many things that are out of his control, finding himself powerless to do much about crises spinning out around him. That landed for me, and I did enjoy the episode, and I get that. So for some reason, there were just little things along the way that didn't feel quite right to me. They, you know, they're having the standoff in Idaho, and Mandy, the paid political consultant, throws her hat in the ring for how it should be handled. I didn't buy it. I thought, really? And then her big innovation is send in a negotiator. Is that a revelatory approach to a hostage situation?
There's no way this will end good. All that's left is to end it fast.
I agree.
What about a negotiator?
Negotiate what?
A peaceful settlement.
This is a standoff with federal officers. A peaceful settlement is put your guns down, you're under arrest.
I think it would be wise if we demonstrated that we exhausted every possible peaceful solution before we got all Ramboed up.
All right, Mandy, thank you.
Not so much that it was so innovative to send in a negotiator that nobody had ever thought of it, but more the idea to try and come out with a peaceful resolution, to not Rambo up, as she says.
I don't know. You know, they come, Josh comes out of the Oval and says, the president's decided to go with your plan. I'm like, what's her plan? Send a negotiator? I just didn't buy that this is her plan. The Mandy plan, having someone negotiate a hostage crisis.
I didn't think that she was trying to come up with it. It was more just that she was advocating. Let's not go in with guns blazing. Let's try and find a peaceful resolution for it, even though her reason for it is because she's thinking about the PR possibilities and how the thing is going to play. She offers this tactical strategy, but it's actually, you know, it's in service of this kind of public appearance thing. And I don't know, I really liked it.
Well, for me, it made that even more of a hard buy that the president is swayed by the optics of this life and death situation that seems out of character.
I don't know.
This is one thing in a long list of credibility issues that I believe this episode has.
All right. Maybe I'm too deep in. I loved all of it. I bought it.
Did the Idaho situation remind you of the Oregon situation?
Sure. Of course.
Of this year, right?
Yes.
The wait and see approach was certainly employed in this most recent situation at the National Wildlife Refuge.
However, the militia in Idaho in the West Wing are much better prepared than the Oregon folks.
Oh, that's right. Someone mentioned starving them out, and the response is they have 5 years' worth of supplies.
As opposed to the please send snacks strategy of the Oregon militia.
That's right. That is a salient point.
Yeah. I was going to say that this was like an A-plus episode for me. I was like, so good.
Don't get me wrong, I thoroughly enjoyed it, but I was thinking, judged against its own potential. It's not a great episode.
Okay.
But maybe I'll ruin your enjoyment of it, or you will enhance my enjoyment of it, as we discuss.
Okay.
Even right off the bat. So we open with CJ is being sort of hectored by a variety of reporters about what the women at the state dinner are going to be wearing.
And we get great tech specs right away. This is the fashion version of our tech spec talk.
The First Lady will be wearing a Karman Mark Volvo silver and black gown with a matching bolero jacket.
Shoes.
I believe she'll be wearing shoes, yes.
CJ.
Black suede and velvet Manolo Blahnik slides with a rhinestone and mother of pearl toe buckle.
Accessories.
Gabrielle Sanchez freshwater pearl necklace with tourmaline beads. I'm also told to inform you she will be carrying a Christina Bamba silk pleated organdy drawstring evening bag.
Here's my complaint, though. CJ is clearly irked by having to deal with the fashion of the state dinner. But she's talking to InStyle magazine and Mirabella. Did she think they wanted to weigh in or ask her questions about the nuclear ban treaty? I mean, this is her day. She's got fashion reporters and lifestyle reporters. What does she expect them to ask her about?
You don't appreciate her being contemptuous.
Either don't let them in or let them ask their questions.
All right, fair enough. CJ gets frustrated with the fashion reporters, but then she walks away from them and we really get led into the episode. There's this cool device of CJ as the press secretary has to be informed of everything because everything coming up could possibly lead to a question from a reporter. So she has to know everything in order to do her job. So we get this little rapid fire thing where everybody's coming in to CJ to give her another piece of information. And they're essentially synopsizing the episode to come by telling her what the major plot lines are. And she's digesting it so that she can then talk to the White House press pool.
So, let me see if I have this. A hurricane's picked up speed and power and is heading for Georgia. Management and labor are coming here to work out a settlement to avoid a crippling strike that'll begin at midnight tonight. And the government's planning a siege on 18 to 40 of its citizens, all the while we host a state dinner for the president of Indonesia.
Yeah,
you got it.
And I read somewhere, I think a little interview with Pat Cadell, who was a famous pollster, I want to say for Carter, and a consultant on the show, that Aaron's marching orders to the staff were, give me a multitude of crises. That was his original idea for this episode, that the state dinner would be taking place in the midst of multiple crises unfolding around them and around the world.
Yeah, it definitely felt like everything was hitting the fan at once. And in the middle of it, we've got the state dinner for the new Indonesian prime minister.
Suguto.
And there's this part where Toby and Sam are talking about the language of the speech that they're writing and sort of how tough it should be.
Do you really think it's a good idea to invite people to dinner and then tell them exactly what they're doing wrong with their lives?
Absolutely. Otherwise, it's just a waste of food.
Toby,
we're not telling them how to run their lives.
It's time for your government to live up to the promise enshrined in the hearts and minds of your people as well as the laws of your land.
Friendly reminder.
It blows up in his face, and he should have seen it coming a mile away, and I think you wind up feeling it ought to blow up in his face.
Yeah. I'm realizing that in a lot of parts of this episode, there's a lack of foresight. The
diplomatic interest of having Indonesia there as your guest. It's important because you want to foster this relationship and you want to foster the idea of these first steps towards democracy. It's in America's best interests. So when Toby decides to go off and criticize him in the toast, he's lacking the foresight to see how that's not going to play well, especially when he has to turn around and then try and ask a favor of this guy to let his friend out of jail. And that seems to be like a recurring thing in this episode. We already talked about Mandy. Let's send in the negotiator because she wants to solve a PR problem. And of course, that doesn't end up going well. It doesn't go at all the way that she planned. Leo tells President Bartlett,
I just wanted to let you know we're going to clear out a battle carrier group from the Norfolk Naval Yard.
Because of the hurricane.
Of course, the hurricane ends up reversing course. And once again, like there's this lack of foresight and disaster comes with it. I mean, not that you could really predict that a hurricane is going to reverse course, but yeah. They're trying to solve something. They're trying to address these problems. But in the end, there's a turn of the screw and everything changes.
Well, let me address a couple of those.
Okay.
You're not going to have anyone over for a state dinner if you stick to the moral absolutism that Toby might espouse at times. Nor could we be a guest to anyone else. It's just, and it's Bambang, who eventually points out our own checkered history with Native Americans and throws it back and Toby's face.
Does it strike you at all hypocritical that a people who systematically wiped out a century's worth of Native Americans should lecture the world so earnestly on human rights?
Yes, it does.
You humiliated my president tonight, and for no other reason than to show off. And now you want me to do you a favor? Go to hell.
So I agree with you there. Is there some great lack of foresight in the send in a negotiator plan? It didn't land to me like, what a stupid plan. Of course they shot the negotiator, and it would have gone so much better if they had just rushed in guns blazing. This is why part of it didn't work for me, some aspects of this episode. And shouldn't the Navy have a sense of the weather? Why was it? Why were they ahead of the curve? The beginning of the hurricane, and then it moves east, and it completely caught us by surprise. And there's even, and I think this is a mistake, because for me, it highlighted it, if that's a word. There's a little, I want to say, 3 or 4 line interchange between Leo and Bartlett about the Navy getting caught off guard.
Without warning?
Yeah.
The hurricane just shifted direction without any warning?
It's not an anomaly, but it's unusual.
I would think.
So I'm like, yeah, I was already thinking that. I don't think I needed 2 of the main characters to say, wow, this is really unusual.
I still love this episode, but you are making it harder for me to love it.
I don't know. It just, this felt like one of those less than the sum of its parts episodes.
Well, one of the things about Mr. Bambang's line is that it nicely sets up this thing that the First Lady says later. The First Lady, played by Starker Channing, she makes her first appearance on the West Wing. And she says,
it's our history. Better or worse, it's our history. We're not going to lock it in the basement or brush it with a new coat of paint. It's our history.
I think that's just a great way of approaching the reality of American politics. You have to acknowledge what's actually happened in order to move on and address it.
This is Abby Bartlett in response to the Gold Vermeil issue.
Yeah.
Another subplot that takes place completely off camera. And you're right. Had Toby continued that conversation with Bambang, he might have said something along those lines. Because what's being thrown in his face, while not ancient history, is early American history, and the idea that you acknowledge it and learn from it and perhaps move on from it might have been a reasonable argument for him to make in response rather than standing there completely with egg on his face.
Did you know what vermeil was before you watched this episode?
Indeed, I did.
You strike me as the kind of person who would.
Thank you. You're kind. Well, my wife's store is a rose in the Pacific Palisades. We sell some jewelry, some of which is gold, and some is gold vermeil.
See, I thought that you might know because of your wife's store, and the reason why I suspected is because of the day when you accidentally started texting me photos of things that you were meant for her. You were sending me like photos of like inlaid china and things like that that were supposed to be for the store.
I believe I was sending you some Limoges Zodiac eggs.
That's
we were
right.
thinking of buying.
That is exactly right.
Yeah. That was embarrassing. I'm much more careful now, making sure I'm texting the right person.
Why was that embarrassing? That was great. It gave me insight that you would probably be the kind of person who knew what vermeil was without them having to explain it on the.
I'm one of those people who has no interest in giving his friends insight into him in any way.
Too late. About the vermeil thing, the action, the protest is off screen, but I would say that isn't really where the action is. The action is really between CJ and Danny.
Yes, sparks.
I think the whole thing is that the protest is so minor, it's so small, that really he is, as she says,
you're a rabble rouser, you know that? You rouse rabble.
Because, you know, just like we were talking about earlier, CJ has to be prepared for any question that might come up from the press, either with a statement or to be ready to make a statement. And just by getting the question from a White House reporter, it's now a real issue. He's just given them a platform. And he's just doing it, it seems like, to mess with her. Whereas before, we had the sort of like inkling that their relationship was maybe a little bit more, that he got to receive some special treatment. As you put it, this is the downbeat to their relationship.
And I noticed that CJ was less put off when Danny asked her what she was going to wear to the state dinner than when the reporters were asking about the first lady and others.
Right. Yeah. Speaking of flirting, I think my favorite moment in this episode is something that I'm not sure I would have noticed if it hadn't been for our conversation with Janelle Maloney and her revealing that from the first episode, every single one of her moves was motivated by the idea that Donna is in love with Josh. There's a thing that she does where she adjusts Josh's tie.
Your kitchen guy doesn't speak English.
You're kidding me.
Well, no, he speaks Batak in Portuguese, so I wouldn't look down your nose.
Is the bar open yet?
Yeah.
Make this work.
I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, I definitely noticed that. And then later, Josh adjusts Sam, so it's a bit of love triangle.
Uh-huh. In this scene, she apologizes, and just before she leaves the room, she touches his tie, just like touches it and straightens it. And it's such an intimate gesture. There's something about the absent-mindedness of it that makes it even more intimate. I really love Donna in this episode. And despite the fact that she has to take on these lines of about sorcerers being beheaded, whatever.
I just thought you might like to know that in certain parts of Indonesia, they summarily execute people they suspect of being sorcerers.
What?
I read it.
They summarily execute people they suspect of being sorcerers.
They behead them.
Sorcerers.
Gangs of roving people, beheading those they suspect of being sorcerers with, you know, what's that thing that death carries?
A scythe.
They're doing it with a scythe.
Well, thanks for the heads up.
I just thought you might like to know who's coming over for dinner.
You bet.
Despite that beheading stuff, which is ridiculous, you really do see her doing all kinds of important work. Like she tracks down Charlie's grandparents and she's arranging the translators, even though, you know, she doesn't have all the right intel, you see how much of an important part of the machine she is.
At the risk of piling on, did any of what she had to say then mixed in with all the inability to communicate language-wise, did any of this episode to you smack of mild xenophobia?
Huh.
Because that struck me a little bit too. I felt like some of the characters were not given their roles in our government might have had a more inclusive, less phobic reaction to others. There's one line during the funny translation scene where Toby kind of starkly tells the kitchen worker,
you might want to take a crack at English one day, seeing as how you live here.
That set me back a little bit.
I caught that and I was like, is that the position that Toby would take? I mean, certainly, yes, you've mastered two very difficult languages, but the way he puts it is a little bit harsh.
That's what I felt. Tonally, it felt a little bit jarring coming from Toby.
I can't imagine that he would be like a absolutist when it comes to immigrant assimilation and stuff like that.
Have I ruined the episode for you yet?
You're taking some...
I'm trying.
Yeah, you've taken some shots. I'm not feeling as good as I was when I finished it. You know, the ending is so good, I thought that I was...
That I will say.
Can you tell us what's going on?
Well, we're looking at, I guess, 80-foot seas with winds up to 120 knots. shipping solid green water over the bow, and we've got a fire in the engine room. Lost the running lights and may get run over by an aircraft carrier that can't see in the dark.
Well, I don't know, man. Sounds pretty bad, Harold. I think I'd ask for my money back.
It's a beautiful piece of writing and acting. Even the guy.
Signalman Third Class.
Nice. Signalman Third Class Harold Lewis, as played by Jeff Williams entirely in voiceover. He's good. And it's again, a testament to Aaron's writing in this cast and their acting that, you know, at this point, I was fully bought in, and it's a quiet, very impactful scene, and most of the rest of the staff is just in a semicircle behind him as the president tells the sailor,
I'm going to stay right here as long as the radio works, okay?
Yes, sir.
Very compelling, very powerful.
Yeah.
I'm not going to ruin that for you.
Okay. Thank you. Knowing how names figure in Aaron Sorkin's work, I was wondering if it meant anything to you that Signalman Third Class
Harold Lewis.
Harold Lewis, like Lance Corporal Harold Dawson, one of the characters in A Few Good Men. And in both cases, these Harolds are relatively low-ranked servicemen who are in over their heads. And just like how psychiatrists are always named Stanley, I thought it was interesting that they were both named Harold.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure there's an entire treatise to be written about Aaron Sorkin and the naming of characters.
Yeah.
He makes up a cellist, Yo-Yo Ma. What a crazy name. Just kidding. By the way, you want to talk about the difference between seasons 1 and 2 of The West Wing and the, I guess, level of popularity and success. In season 1, there's a mention of Yo-Yo Ma playing some buck at the state dinner. Season 2, Yo-Yo Ma shows up and plays the cello in an episode. So
he plays Bach, in fact.
Ah, very nice. Where do you stand on Bartlett telling the Indonesian prime minister that he's going to play Bach concertos instead of concerti as a music guy? Is that acceptable?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. Just looking for something else to complain about.
I love when people call more than one cello celli. I love that.
I like when baseball players refer to the various stadia. I think I got that from Tom Lehrer. But
you know that octopi is not the plural of octopus?
I do know that because my wife just read a book called The Soul of an Octopus. And now all she talks about is octopuses.
Did you hear about that octopus that escaped out of its tank?
Yes. Well, apparently they are incredibly smart. They just have very few venues in which to show their intelligence.
Yeah, if we lived underwater, they would be our overlords.
That's right.
They absolutely would be our overlords.
One of the many reasons I refuse to live underwater. Let me ask you this. Why does Danny have free access to CJ's office?
That's a nice dress.
You're not supposed to be back here right now.
She's sitting there and she's working and he just shows up. He's a reporter. Let me ask you this, more access credibility issues. Lori comes to the White House to the state dinner, a professional call girl under an alias. Where's the guy at the door demanding to see what is going on?
Okay, no, that's a good point. There's going to be some pretty heavy security if you're going to get invited to a state dinner.
One would also think that she would have had to know enough ahead of time to bring her passport or whatever it is that you need to get to the White House. And she might have maybe let him know that she's coming to the White House. It's a nice reveal when it turns out that she's on the arm of David Rashi.
Her date, his name is Carl Everett.
Yes, Lori arrives on Carl Everett's arm.
I wasn't thinking about this one too closely here, but how do you show up to the White House as somebody's plus one with no background check? I don't know. Josh, you were invited to the correspondence dinner.
And I'm not going.
And you're not going.
Is it here we pay tribute to what a good father I am? I am not going because my daughter's school has a very important daddy-daughter event.
Which is so sweet and so infuriating.
Yes, because think of all the people I could connect with and get onto our podcast.
Yeah, exactly. I offered to go in a full David Rosen cosplay outfit and see if anybody would notice, but apparently you didn't think that was a good idea.
And by the way, if you want to know what the full David Rosen cosplay outfit is, it's a Hugo Boss suit and old age makeup. I have been to the White House. I went to the Hanukkah party, the White House Hanukkah party. Say it with me, Hanukkah. And there was a lot of waiting in line and showing ID.
You did have to show a lot of ID.
I think I might have had my passport with me, and it certainly didn't strike me as the kind of place where, like, I'm going to make up a funny name.
Right. And they expected you. They were like, yes, you are on the list.
Yes.
You couldn't bring just an anonymous plus one if you wanted.
No. I think they frown on that.
Yeah.
Oh, she's with me.
Yeah.
The Sam and Lori scene is getting a little ragged around the edges by this episode.
Yeah, I'm over it. I'm over it.
That's how I felt.
I was over it after the second episode, really.
I can't even tell in this episode whether we are to believe that there's anything romantic between them.
I think there is.
Neither of them seems particularly, to me, interested in the other. I don't know why she's hanging out with him, because all he really does is sort of obnoxiously lobby her to not do what she's chosen to do with her life. So he's just a drag. I couldn't even quite tell whether they're supposed to still think there's potential romance here or just a really messed up friendship.
I mean, it starts off in the diner. It seems like they are just friends. It seems like they're just pals.
Although they are eating pickles at each other, which to me is suggestive.
That's true. It is. It's a little, there is some of that going on. But, you know, they're friends, but they're friends who have had sex.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of those.
So you were surprised by Sam's offer.
I'll give you $10,000 not to go home with that guy tonight.
Again, it didn't seem like it came out of his moral stance on her being a prostitute. It really just seemed like he was incredibly jealous at that moment.
That is true. And in a very ham-handed way, he offers her money to do something she doesn't want to do because he feels she takes money to do something she doesn't want to do.
Yeah.
It's not a great thought process. I think in a way, I'm anxious. I think Rob is terrific in the show. I'm anxious for him to move on to other things, where I think Sam Seaborn really comes more alive and more fully realized later on.
Absolutely. That's been maybe the most surprising takeaway for me in rewatching this time around, is how much it doesn't feel like Sam is the character that I think of yet. He seems sort of on the peripheries. It doesn't feel like Sam has emerged yet.
While we're on it also, and we'd like to do our little crossovers with real life, I'm sure everybody listening knows there is a situation that's come out in the last few weeks about this conservative MP, the culture secretary, John Whittingdale.
The story first surfaced on Byline.com that John Whittingdale in late 2013 had a relationship with a woman who was a prostitute. Whittingdale's office has told Newsnight he had no idea his girlfriend at the time was a sex worker at the London retreat.
Again, it's just another one of those weird West Wing life imitates art crossovers.
The opposite of ripped from the headlines, ripped from the plot lines.
Yeah, exactly. Well said.
There was a new step in this episode with the president and Leo. I felt like with this little exchange where President Bartlett just says, he says,
"What do I do now?"
And Leo says,
"Go back to the party."
This is different from asking for advice. This is the president saying, literally, "What do I do?" And it shows to me how much he relies on Leo's support.
I did want to point out one nice, I feel like while we have not been Moira Kelly bashing, we've been negative largely in our response to Mandy. And I wanted to point out, I thought she had a great moment.
What happened?
They shot the FBI negotiator. He's in critical condition.
Ladies and gentlemen, President and Mrs. Bartlett, accompanied by President and Mrs. Ram Seguto.
Mandy?
I should call. On the phone. I'm gonna throw up.
Her reaction is, I thought, very real and very compelling, and it was a nice little moment from Moira Kelly, who is a good actor.
Yeah, it must be tough, right? I mean, you get this all the time where people conflate your character with you.
Absolutely. I don't really mind it because I don't care whether people hate me. I just usually say, you understand, I don't write them, I act them out. I don't care whether people like the characters I'm playing. It may or may not be a goal of the people writing my characters, but as an actor, I just act what's on the page and let people respond how they do. I don't care about being likable. I don't care what people think or ascribe to my character or think about his motivations. It just doesn't matter to me. I guess you get a little proprietary about a character in terms sometimes of thinking, well, I don't think he would do that. I mean, there's a certain continuity you want, I guess, as an actor. And way down the line, there's some specific situations in The West Wing that we could discuss with some of the cast about how they felt about the way their plot lines and their characters' decisions went. But other than that, I don't worry too much about how people respond to a character I'm playing.
It makes me wonder whether Mandolin was supposed to have been written like that. If the idea was, let's have this one person who kind of can sometimes drive a wedge between the staff or be a foil or cause frustration for Josh in a not necessarily charming way.
That's a fascinating question. And when we get Aaron on here, I don't know whether he'll want to discuss it, but it would be certainly interesting to delve into that.
Well, in the meantime, let's pose it to our listeners. Let us know on our website or on our Facebook page, do you think that Mandy is supposed to be likable or is she supposed to be unlikable?
This is the first episode, even not loving her particular subplot, I felt compassion for her. Josh is really mistreating her in this episode.
You think so?
Look, they're ex-lovers. He's not rooting for her or buoying her in the workplace at all, to the point where she explicitly says to him,
do you really believe that? Or are you just pissed off because I got in the game?
This is her step up, whether you buy it or not, to the big leagues. She's in the Oval Office and gets the president's ear and actually affects his decision, an unfolding crisis of life and death. And Josh Lyman's just irked by it all. The point where he actually even says to her, yeah, it does bug me. And then she leaves and then he mutters to himself, yeah, it really does, or something like that.
I didn't take it like that. I thought that he was more bothered by the idea that it wasn't about her personally. It's more just that he really felt like he knew what the right answer is. You know, I think he makes a good point. He says,
this isn't abstract, Mandy. This isn't a theoretical problem. The FBI says come out with your hands up. You come out with your hands up. At which point you were free to avail yourself of the entire justice system.
And he's used to being advising at this level. Here's somebody without this kind of experience who's coming in and trying to influence decision in a way that I would disagree with. I don't think that it's particular to Mandy. I think that he would be as dismissive to anybody.
To me, in this episode, he seems like he's annoyed slash slightly threatened by Mandy. When he tells her that the negotiator has been shot and is in critical condition, he seems to have absolutely no empathy for the fact that she's going to feel guilty for how it unfolded. He just lays it out there with an, I think, unspoken kind of, I told you so.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's rough. And I don't know if he does treat everyone that way.
Well, should we end just as negatively as the episode does on just a downer?
I can see a positive place to end it. There is a lovely scene between Stockard Channing and Martin Sheen in which we see the extent to which Abby knows her husband and understands him completely.
You know, one of the things that happens when I stay away too long is that you forget that you don't have the power to fix everything. You have a big brain and a good heart and an ego the size of Montana. You do, Jed. You don't have the power to fix everything. But I do like watching you try.
All this stuff happening on a world stage, and then there's this little beautiful human moment between the president and his wife.
The I do like watching you try line was it's pretty special.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break.
And when we come back, we'll talk to Lynn Paolo about her Emmy-nominated work on this episode. Now back to the show. We're joined now by costume designer Lynn Paolo, whose work you've seen on more shows than we have time to name, including ER, Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, and of course The West Wing. She's a designer for Scandal, where she continues to work with Josh, and in collaboration with Kerry Washington, she's created a line based on Olivia Pope's looks for The Limited. She's working right now on the upcoming show Animal Kingdom, but we managed to get her on the phone in a break between fittings. Lynn, we're talking about episode 7 of season 1 of The West Wing, The State Dinner. Do you remember working on that one?
I do remember it, and I actually watched it last night to remind myself of the horror of it all, and I say that jokingly, but we had not a lot of time to get everything done, not the least of which was the Indonesian costumes.
I hadn't even considered that part. I was just thinking about, you know, the first lady's dress.
Yeah, the famous cleavage dress.
I have something called The West Wing, the companion book published by Warner Brothers. And you say in it, we had to fit Stockard only an hour before she went to the set. So we had the famous cleavage dress, which Stockard loves. But the rest of America was very upset because the first lady should not have cleavage. We got more letters about that dress than anything else. So really, did it in fact cause an uproar?
It really did, and it was fascinating because it was Stockard's very first episode, and she flew in from New York, and her deal was not set, and so, as often happens, costumes were scrambling, and we had about 15 or 20, maybe more dresses in the room, and really, that was the only one that worked, and I was supremely nervous about the cleavage. And Stockard was like, well, you know, it's okay. Women have breasts. It's going to be fine. But we did get a lot of backlash. I rewatched the show last night and thought, well, it looks fine to me now and looking back at it. But at the time, it was a great deal of controversy about it, which was sort of, I don't know, really interesting. But then recently with Mrs. Obama showing her arms for a portrait, you got that same backlash. And I thought, oh my gosh, these poor first ladies, what they have to go through. Yeah.
People have a very set conception of how the first lady should dress and comport herself, I guess.
It was an interesting moment in my career because I thought, oh, I've offended every American I know. But...
no, I think, I'm guessing most people appreciated it. She looked fantastic.
I think she looked amazing. I looked at it last night and thought, well, I don't know what all the fuss was about at the time. But yeah, it was a challenging episode on many levels. But that was sort of the backlash, as it were.
I had a question about the dress itself. CJ says that it's a Carmen Mark Volvo dress. Is that accurate?
The thing about Aaron that's absolutely amazing, and I adore that man, is that whatever we were doing for the costumes on the show, I would get this sort of cryptic call from him going, you know, Lynn, what do you think the ladies are wearing like that? You know, the way he talks. And I would tell him, you know, I'd say, well, I think it's going to be this, and these are the shoes, and this is the blah, blah. And he would always write it in, which is why, you know, the Vera Wang dress episode was about a Vera Wang dress. So, right. Because that's what she wore. So he was always very inclusive in that way. And even, you know, the discussion in the episode about the Indonesian national dress.
Mrs. Segura will be wearing a traditional silk kagaya in dark purple with an overlay of black silk lace.
You know, I showed Aaron pictures and then, you know, he included that as well. So it's kind of a lovely thing when your producer, writing producer, goes to all that trouble to make sure that, you know, everyone who's helped you too on the show gets a little bit of a shout out.
How many background do you think you had to...
Oh my God, it was in the hundreds, definitely in the hundreds, Josh.
Hundreds?
Hundreds. And the thing that was, I mean, honestly, I keep harping on it, but it wasn't just the gowns for the ladies and the Western dress, but I was on the phone with the British Embassy, the British Consulate, and the Indonesian Consulate here, trying to get anybody to give me research. And we ended up asking someone from the Indonesian Consul to come to the set and help us. And I couldn't find any appropriate, you know, national costumes from the Indonesian area. So we ended up making everything.
Wow.
When you look at the episode, you don't see it. Do you know? It's sort of an interesting thing and a thing that I struggle with, that you put all this work into something and then it's sometimes not seen because the camera only sees what it sees, yeah? And the lens is only pointed in one direction. So we didn't see all these amazing, bright, vibrant costumes that we created for the episode that was They were just stunning.
That's painful.
It was sort of heartbreaking. I mean, there's one shot, I think, their first ladies being seated, but other than that. And the other sort of quirky costume thing that happened, we went rather long that day. And our band, who was supposed to be the Marine Corps band, halfway through the day had to leave because they had another gig somewhere else and no one had done the shot of them yet. And
they had a bar mitzvah to play.
Yeah, probably. And they, you know, head to toe in the full Marine dress. And over lunch, I was in the trailer with my crew fitting extras who had no idea how to play the instruments. We just did a quick shot of the band and completely re-altering all those uniforms to fit people that, you know, obviously were never going to fit in them. And at one point, we just split the back of a jacket and sort of pinned it down the back because we had no more time left. So someone's sitting there, I think, playing away with the violin and the whole back of their jacket is wide open. Brilliant.
That's fantastic. Well, let me ask you this, because it is a little bit of a heartbreaking story to have made all these beautiful, to have constructed these costumes and then for them not to be seen much. What happens when you've built these beautiful, authentic Indonesian pieces? What happens to them?
Well, everything ends up down in the Warner Brothers, because that was the company, you know, who produced the show, costume department. And it's sort of an interesting thing because even last week I was walking down stairs at Warner Brothers pulling pieces for an episode of Scandal. And there was Abby Bartlett's dress still hanging down there, still, you know, just being used by other shows, I imagine, at this point. And it made me a little bit sad because I would imagine it should probably be in an archive or something. So
the Smithsonian, one would hope.
Yeah, after this, I might pop up front and mention to them that it's down there.
I always assumed that when you had something like that, some outside designer's dress, that it might be a loaner, and then you have to give it back afterwards.
It was a really interesting time because, you know, it was, I think, what was it, the first season, episode 6 or 7, something like that?
Episode 7.
Yeah, so the show, we did not have a massive budget on that show, nor did we have some of the contacts that I might have now later on in my career. And it was, we were a very budget-conscious show at the time, and we did not get to borrow things. It was literally, you know, me running around Beverly Hills purchasing things. Now with the advent of social media, I would probably have much more access to designers than I had back then. We were just very budget conscious at the time.
Well, kudos to you, because it does not look like they're scrimping on budget at all. It looks grand and lush. You did a very good job, I guess.
Thank you.
Working on a budget.
Could you talk to us about how you came to the West Wing, how you got the gig?
I'm always grateful to the West Wing because every other job I've ever gotten has been because of the West Wing, including Scandal. But I was working on ER for John Wells, and I'm not fond of going to parties or any of that stuff, but I was invited to a say goodbye to one of our actors from ER party, and I sort of forced myself to go. So I went to the commissary that night, and John Wells, who was the executive producer of the show, turned to me and said, "So I think we're going to have this new show. Would you be interested?" And I said, yeah, I guess. And that was my interview right there. So, of course, I met Aaron, and I knew Tommy Schlamme from our many projects together in the past. And Aaron just said, "Oh, I love her. It's great." And that was it. I mean, there was no presentation, no interview process. I just kind of walked into it, which was really, when I look back, sort of amazing at the time. I just didn't even think anything of it, but that was it. Unbelievable, really.
Was there a learning curve for you once you got on the show? Was it different from the experiences you'd had before?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the thing about the West Wing that I loved was that we were all careful and precise. We wanted to do a great job. You know, we wanted to present the West Wing in as true a light as we could. So we all spend a lot of time doing research, which is one of my favorite things to do, and not something that I get to do so much anymore, because some of the shows I work on now, that is not the point of view. But on the West Wing, and specifically with Aaron, he wanted everyone to come to the table in a concept meeting with as much knowledge about what would really happen in the West Wing. And so I loved that. And I learned so much. I mean, even just this episode, having to research, you know, another country's customs, it was a joy. And researching the uniforms and researching, you know, what would a first lady wear? What have previous first ladies worn to these state dinners? And we did a lot of research on all of that. And we did throughout the whole, I think, what was it, seven seasons?
Speaking of the seven seasons, I was wondering, what was it like to dress Josh on The West Wing versus how you dress Josh on Scandal?
Both, just such an exciting opportunity for you both.
Now, the stories that we could tell, my friend. You know, there are two different people. And I think we're more dapper now, don't you, Josh?
Indeed. Yes, I think so. Well, it speaks to what you were saying earlier. I think the DC of The West Wing and the DC of Scandal are sort of inverse challenges. One, you were trying to be as authentic as possible and doing a lot of research. On the other, you're sort of allowed to be more fashion forward and kind of drive the look.
Exactly. And both are wonderful ways to work. I'm really loving being on Scandal and having this new sort of DC vibe going on. And, you know, we were a lot more sloppy on The West Wing. Everything was always late at night. I mean, I always remember you always had your jacket off and your tie loose, and we don't That's do right. a lot of that. You're so fancy now. It's really interesting because I know I got the job on Scandal because of The West Wing, because Shonda loved The West Wing.
Helped me too.
It helped us all. That's what I'm saying. It's the gift that keeps on giving. But yeah, it's fascinating to be in these two worlds that are sort of the same world, but to tweak them differently. Mm-hmm. It's really fun.
For this episode, you were nominated for an Emmy. And I was wondering if you remember that moment when you found out that you were nominated.
I was a little bit shocked when we got nominated, because to me, it just felt like, you know, it was just another episode. I didn't really think of it in terms of the costumes. Stockard and I laughed afterwards when I didn't win and said that we probably thought her cleavage had lost it for me, which was something that we really enjoyed giggling about in the room. I do remember that the night of the actual Emmy ceremony, I got a call from Aaron asking me, are you going to be there? Because I really need you to tie my bow tie. And I was like, yeah, I think I'm going to be there. So that's a very fond memory. It was a lovely moment, and especially for my crew. They worked terrifically hard. It was, in as you know, Josh, just challenging to get all of that done in such a short amount of time. So I was lovely watching it last night. I actually cried at the end. Such a moving. And the writing, you know, is it just Aaron is just a master. Fantastic work.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Lynn, for talking to us. And thanks to all of you for listening to the episode. If you'd like to discuss it with us or with other listeners, you can make a comment on our webpage, thewestwingweekly.com, or on our Facebook page, facebook.com/thewestwingweekly. You can also find us on Twitter. I'm at Rishi Hirway, Josh is at Josh Molina, and Lynn is at Lynn Paolo. The podcast is at West Wing Weekly.
Okay.
Okay.
What's next?
Radiotopia.